Well, I got into magic by default.
Okay, when you were younger?
Yes. Yeah. When we migrated from Malta, I'm going to get personal here.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Charles Gauchy is 77 years old with a wealth of experience. He put much of it into a book entitled A Lifetime of Magic. For many years, he regularly performed on the French Riviera for the rich and famous, and did quite well. He is an inventor and creator of 302 different commercial tricks, his most successful one being Eye to Eye. Charles recently passed through North America for his farewell lecture tour. He toured through cities in Canada and the U.S. While he was here in Houston, we sat down for a little discussion that covered a lot of areas, including his beginnings as a hypnotist, working with Peter Ravine, how he got the jobs on the French Riviera, and much more. It's all coming up here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have with me as my guest today Mr. Charles Gauchy. Hey there, Charles.
Hi, Scott.
So glad to have you over here all the way from Australia. You're here on a lecture tour.
That's correct.
So it sounds like that things have been going pretty successfully for you so far.
Yes, I'm very, very pleased with the result.
And I'd forgotten how many cities, about a dozen or so cities, I think, that you've kind of been going to.
Yes, plus
Canada.
I had about three others also.
Yeah.
So
it was really a North American 15, tour.
About 15, yes.
Yeah, it wasn't just the U.S. That you were.
No, and I went to Canada also. Yeah. Toronto, just one quick gig.
Yeah.
It was good.
With this is going to be your, quote, farewell tour.
Well, it is. For a couple of reasons, really. Whilst I love the US, I've been here 17 times altogether. Sometimes just come for a holiday.
Yep.
Not necessarily for magic. But from the point of view of lecturing, this business of flying back to the hub every time just annoys the hell out of me.
Yeah.
You know, a 2-hour flight ends up taking 7.5 hours.
Because you have a layover.
Yeah.
Fly into Atlanta,
yeah,
back out of there.
One place I had to wait 3.5 hours between flights.
Yeah.
And if I'd flown direct, it would have been a 2-hour flight.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And I mean, it's ridiculous. And then all the security crap that you've got to go. I mean, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have it, but it's just taking the fun out of it.
Do you have the same kinds of, TSA issues, you know, as far as security issues, UK, in Australia? As far as your pat down,
we're lucky from the point of view that, like your major airports, we do have the very latest.
Yeah.
So it's a case of walking in, putting your hands up,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. Your smaller airports, of course, it's a pain in the butt.
Right. that's true. But I would think that most of the international locations you've been going through have been, you know, more of the scanners.
Yes.
That you'd walk through kind of thing.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's not a problem. And the good thing here is that if you're over 70, you don't have to take your shoes off, and
right,
you don't have to take the belt off. So there, yeah, are a couple of pluses.
So this being, again, your, quote, last tour, that, as I understand it, that you only have a limited amount of product still left, meaning that you have a book and everything and some other things that you have sold. But once,
no,
you're,
I didn't even
out,
bother bringing the book,
oh,
because,
okay,
from my point of view, I was given X number, and I sold out of them very quickly.
Yeah.
We only had a limited edition. Mm-hmm. Originally, we asked the printer to print 500. He ended up printing 550.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't touched base with Joe to see if he's got any left.
Okay. Is Joe
far too busy? No, Joe Stevens.
Joe Stevens, sorry.
Who published it originally.
Okay. And what's the title again?
But it's A Lifetime of Charles Gauchy's A Lifetime of Magic. I was rather surprised. One club, only a few nights back, five members came up each with a book.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, for one club, it blew me away, I must confess. So I had to autograph all the books.
When was the book published?
What's this, 2000? About 2012.
Okay, so it's only just a couple.
But
of
look, it was priced very expensively.
Mm-hmm.
and there was a reason for it. I've got a database myself of over 16,000 magicians.
Yeah.
We could have easily printed
and
sold it cheap. But I just felt that a number of my favorite effects were in it. And, you know, you can laugh at me, but I just thought, why kill it? It was mainly aimed at the collectors, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very happy with the result.
Yeah. And so there are still a few copies that are available through Joe
Stevens. I think Joe might have a few copies left. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, as far as the rest of the products, I mean, you know, Eye to Eye and some other.
I didn't bother bringing Eye to Eye with me. I mean, Eye to Eye has been my biggest bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
I've turned over $675,000 worth.
What?
Eye to Eye, yes.
Goodness sakes. Explain the effect to those who don't know that.
Well, Eye to Eye is a sort of a witch hand effect, although I've changed it a hell of a lot now from my own personal presentation.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the idea is that you can have a coin or a bill, and you play for money. What makes the effect is the fact that I play for three $100 notes. I repeat the effect three times. And if I fail to guess which hand the note or the bill, or the coin is hidden in,
mm-hmm.
they keep the 100.
Right.
And it plays. When you play for money, for that sort of money, you have audiences sitting on the edge of the seat, wondering where you're going to succeed.
Right.
In fact, I could tell you a really funny story. I was in Vegas about 7 years ago, and there's an African-American hypnotist, Justin Trans.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of my customers. He just buys everything I produce. Anyway, he found out that I was in Vegas at a convention, and he sent one of his guys along, and he said, come along afterwards to the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I invited Barry Richardson and Bill Palmer from memory and three or four other guys. I said, oh, we might as well go and have a look at the show.
Sure.
At the end of the show, he turned around and he said, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a famous mentalist from Australia. Perhaps if you clap loud enough, he'll come up and do something. And I thought to myself, when's your mother going to marry your father? I mean, fortunately, I still had the ear gimmicks in my ear. Because I at conventions I keep them there all the time.
Oh.
Anyway, I got up and I asked for, knowing that this is Vegas, I said I'd like someone to come up and match wits with me,
mm-hmm.
But I need someone who considers themselves to be a terrific bluffer.
Yeah.
Young fellow came up from New York. He was about 28. I asked him a few questions. Anyway, so we play the first time for 100 and I win. The second time I deliberately lost,
mm-hmm.
and the boys were literally shitting themselves, wondering if something went wrong, but I did it deliberately.
Yeah.
I took a punt, and then I put the guy on the spot. I said to him, let's see what you're made of, double or nothing, 400 or nothing, because he took the bait, I won the money back.
Clever.
But it played well.
And got a good ovation.
Good result.
That's kind of interesting. The guy would put you on a spot like that, say, hey, come on up and do something during his show.
Yeah, well, frankly, it would have been embarrassing because he didn't let me know beforehand. You know, and in a way, I thought that was wrong.
Yeah, well, it could
have been a theater of about 500 people.
Yeah.
And fortunately, as I say, I had the ear gimmicks in, so I was able to perform.
So you are not selling those anymore? I mean, that they're gone?
I've sold over 16,000 now,
mm-hmm.
Eye to Eye, in different forms.
Yeah.
I
remember seeing Jason Alexander do that at the Mindvention 1 year, too.
I've seen Jason do it, not at Mindvention, but a clip.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He's done the Magic Castle.
It was rather interesting, yes.
Yeah.
Very interesting indeed. But I've been very lucky out of the 19 commercial effects I've produced. You know, body language has been worth a mint to me.
I love body language, yeah.
Body language. The Houdini. When I come to the States, I buy 1,000 decks at a time.
Mm-hmm.
and ship them to England, 200 to England, 200 to France, Germany, depending on where I'm going to go.
It's cheaper to buy them here in the U.S.?
Oh, yes. And I have them drilled here.
Yeah.
And then I ship them because of the weight. You know, they're very heavy.
Yeah.
This time I brought with me 100, and over 50 went to the...
At the Mine Venture.
At Mine Venture, I couldn't believe it. And by the sixth lecture, I sold out. So I've been taking orders. I've got orders for 37, which I'll get made up when I get back.
When you get back.
And I'm only taking orders. I have no stock. I no longer advertise any stuff on my website at all.
So are you looking to kind of retire, semi-retire? Or
no way. No. I'll keep going. I'll do a John Calvert.
I mean... Well, I hope
live magic. I live magic 24/7, and I'll continue.
I find it interesting. You know, at lunch we were talking earlier about you being out of the magic business for like 17 years.
Yes.
I brought back into it. I want to discuss that a little bit. But what did you do during that 17 years?
Well, I got into magic by default.
Okay, when you were younger.
Yes, yeah. when we migrated from Malta. I'm going to get personal here. At 12 and a half, I was still wetting the bed. And my siblings used to give me a very hard time. Mm-hmm. Well, one day my mother came and said, oh, there's a famous hypnotist coming to town. I'll take you to see the matinee. Mm-hmm. Well, at 12 and a half, you're very impressionable. And when I saw what this guy was doing with the people on stage, I was in awe.
Yeah.
After the show, he was selling a book for a guinea, £1, one shilling, which back in 1950 was a lot of money. And I talked my mother into buying me the book. Mm-hmm. I read it about 10 times, taught myself self-hypnosis, and did what no doctor could do. Within 5 weeks, I stopped wetting the bed.
I'll be.
And I became hooked.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into magic by default, more or less. One day, I walked into a secondhand bookstore, and I said to the guy, who I'm still very good friends with, I said, do you have any books on hypnosis, secondhand books? He said, yes. And as he was leading me to the section, he said, are you interested in magic? I said, I don't know a thing about it. He said, would you like to come to my club? And that's how I was introduced to the Australian Society of Magicians. And about 50 years later, I ended up president for about 6 years. So it's been an exciting life.
So you went from hypnosis into magic. Now, at that
well,
time...
Well, no, I started professionally at 16.
Yeah.
In actual fact, my start was touring Victoria with Peter Raveen.
Oh, wow.
I actually, with his first few shows...
Were you actually doing magic, or were you working...
No, what was happening was this. I was his stooge.
Oh.
Very early on, when I joined the magic club, I had a look at what every other pro was doing, and I decided I want to do something different. So I developed an Indian act, wearing a turban, and I'd do fire eating, sleeping on a bed of nails, which made me a lot of money, memory routine, and the bullet catching. In fact, I think I published my bullet catching method in the Genie back in the 70s.
Hmm.
Anyway, so through another friend, I learned about Peter, introduced to him. So what used to happen was this. We'd tour a country, we'd do a run along the country of maybe 300 miles. We had an advanced publicity manager who'd go to a town the day before, find a suitable shop window, and then we'd go in there about 11 o'clock, and there'd be a radio interview, et cetera, et cetera. And Peter would pretend to hypnotize me, and they'd pick me up and lay me on this bed. And
a
I'd
nail.
Stay there till 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And then they would pick me up and wake me up on stage.
Huh.
And I could tell you some really incredible stories about
that. Give us just one.
Well, we're in a town called Albury, which is on the border of Sydney and Melbourne, and we're right opposite the courthouse. Now, I'm 19 years of age at this stage,
mm-hmm.
and I'm lying there, and every hour, the compere would ask three people to come in the window and stand on me, just to keep it live.
While you're on the bed of nails.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the beautiful part about this publicity stunt that I'm going back in the 50s now.
Yeah.
That within 1 hour, everybody within 200 miles knew that the Peter Ravine show was in town.
Mm-hmm.
And we play to packed houses. So I'm lying on this bed, and I must have lost control and started dreaming, and I got an erection. Well, I'm not kidding you. What happened then? The word spread around quickly.
Yeah.
People were 30 deep onto the road, and then the drivers were bipping their horns.
Yeah.
The judge couldn't hear what was going on, so he sent a policeman along to find out what the ruckus was all about.
Yeah.
And when he came, and my Bill Howard explained, the MC, that, you know, I've been hypnotized and can't be woken up, they ended up papering the window to stop the show. So that was just one of the many funny incidents we had.
Now, that is an odd one.
It wasn't intentional, but you can imagine a guy lying on a bed of nails having a hard on.
Well, that is something different. Yeah. Nowadays, people pay, you know, to buy Viagra or Cialis. And if you just be hypnotized laying on a bed of nails, then that could happen. Yeah, it could be a whole new business, I think, over there. Now, what was it like working with Peter Ravine? I mean, at that young
age. He was great. He, in fact, in my little, I think in my book I mention about it, because I explain how I performed the bed of nails routine.
Yeah.
And gave away the secret. It's funny, I started inventing things as young as 19.
Hmm.
And that was very original. Another time, on tour, have a look at the scar there.
Well,
you see a huge scar?
I sure do.
We
yeah.
used to,
wow.
because rocks are very hard to get, during the show, they used to put a blacksmith's anvil on my chest, a big one.
Yeah.
And we'd invite,
a real one, not like
yes,
a punch.
Yes, no, a real one.
Okay.
And we'd invite a member of the audience to come in and swing a 14-pound sledgehammer onto it three times.
Wow.
And once it glanced, and as you can see the result,
did it break?
It just hit my foot. It broke, yes, the bone.
And
I had to be operated on. I was out of action for 3 months.
Well, so it had nothing to do with the being impaled on that bed of spikes or anything. It was just
No. Glance
slipping.
Well, it was the days of the what we would call the bodgies and the widgies in those days, and he just swung it, and he missed the anvil, and it glanced off the side.
Yeah.
Onto my foot.
Wow. Wow, that's
so that was a nasty one.
That's interesting. Now, were there other magicians that traveled with Peter that worked with him?
No. This was a straight hypno show.
Okay.
And he did very well. And then after about 2 years, he migrated to America, and I lost touch with him for many, many years.
Yeah. Did you reconnect once he came back?
Yes, I reconnected in Vegas not long ago.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was very sorry to hear of his
passing. Yeah.
But he was, in my opinion, he and the great Franklin, which is the original guy that I saw, I do think Franklin was probably better than Peter. Peter was incredible with his memory routine.
Mm-hmm.
But a great showman, having said that also. But Franklin was an all-around showman. Mm-hmm. He used to have cues 200 or 300 meters long.
Wow.
To get into his show at night. Sell out.
I understand that Peter Ravine used to have a night tour that was supposed to be
yes.
very good.
Because I've never seen him. Now, he never performed that early.
He didn't.
I think he got onto that in Canada.
In later life, okay.
Yeah.
Because I heard that.
In fact, I've got that on a clip. On a video clip, yeah,
mm-hmm.
his performance of that somewhere.
Because that can be something that could be kind of long, boring, and protracted, and I just wondered, you know, if you had seen
yeah, no,
him.
No, I never saw him do it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and also, in a way, not everybody understands
chess. Uh-huh.
Chess.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, to me, it's a bit of a risky thing to perform.
Well, after he left and you broke partnership, I guess, then with him, did you strike out on your own at that time when you were young?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I was very, very lucky. In those days, we had very good agents,
mm-hmm.
Theatrical agents,
as
who
to,
really got you jobs.
Right, as opposed to a party planner today kind of
yeah.
thing. Nothing
no,
to say.
No, these guys really got
work
you jobs.
For you, yeah.
If you had a reasonable act a good act.
Yeah.
I mean, they actually got you bookings. Having said that, I probably gave the agent more bookings than he gave me, because to try and keep sweet,
sure,
every time I got one on the side, I'd still pass on
something to him.
You know, so yeah, you try to do the right thing.
I think you have to do the right thing, yeah.
But, which brings me to a point, and I don't want to sound, what's the correct word?
Old crabby guy.
I believe the proof of the pudding's in the eating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every public show I do, on an average, I get one or two people come up and ask me for a card.
Hmm.
And I get referrals from that.
Hmm.
And I think that, you know, that's a sign that you're doing something right.
Yeah.
If you're not getting that response, I think one has to query what one is doing.
Hmm.
So, you know, one show leads to another.
That's true.
In fact, I've, 2 days ago, I got a booking from a woman I did a show 2 years ago from. She was going to book me last year, and then she didn't. And I thought, oh, that's funny. And now she contacted me and said, are you free 6th of December? And I emailed, because I haven't got my thing with me, I said, I'll get back to you when I get back home.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a daytime, last year it was daytime, so I'll accept it, because I know I'm booked at night. So we'll see.
You never know, because I had a show, a phone call from someone who said, I saw you 25 years ago.
I know.
And he said, I've always said that if I was in a position where I could book you, and he said, I got a big thing in Vegas that I want you to go and do this big conference for us. And it's like, wow, talk about something out of the blue that someone remembered that long.
That brings me to a point, which I mention in my lecture always. If you look at my card, you'll see my photo on it.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at everything I sell, has my photo on it. And at a recent convention, a young buck came up and he said, rather cheekily, I thought, gee, you must love yourself. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you got your photo on everything. Well, being a smart ass, I decided not to explain why.
Yeah.
And the reason I have my photo is simply this. Imagine you're a decision maker. Mm-hmm. General manager, sales manager, whatever.
Right.
Okay. Most of these people have a card file of anything from 2,000 to 6,000.
Sure. Sure.
Supposing he booked me 3 years ago and you want to book me again.
Mm-hmm.
If I have an ordinary card, he's looking among thousands of cards.
Right. Nothing sticks out.
Whereas, you know, people remember faces.
Faces, sure.
They don't remember names, but they remember faces.
Right.
So if he's sorting through quickly, that's the guy I want. Oh, what was his name?
Yeah.
Do you get me? And that's the reason. On everything I have, I've just pushed my photo and my name.
That's good. That's wise. You know, I had changed my logo within the last couple of years for that very reason, where I had just, I say generic, I mean, I had have something that's professionally designed and looks good, and there's a lot of subliminal psychology going on with my logo that I use, but I had removed the spade in the middle and put my face in there then now.
Yeah.
I have on my card.
Yeah.
Because I think that people will remember this.
Oh,
exactly. That's the guy. You know?
That's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's worth a lot of money, that tip.
Sure.
Believe me.
Yeah.
And many magicians don't realize that.
No, you're right. So you continue then to perform, staying in Australia, and for doing magic and or mentalism and or hypnosis?
I started doing, well, I was always interested in hypnosis.
Okay.
From the age of 12 and a half,
sure.
Right? In fact, I'm self-taught. What happened was this. I left school at 13, got special permission,
mm-hmm.
because when we migrated from Malta, the Maltese education system was ahead of Australia, and I went up 4 grades in 1 year.
Wow.
Not because I'm smart, it's just that...
School, yeah, you know, different, sure.
I was ahead. And being European, and with only my mother, because my father passed away before we migrated, and having 2 children, you just got out and worked. So I went to work for a British Australasian Tobacco Company in Melbourne, and I'd finished work at 4:30. I was going to become an apprentice carpenter. And after about a year and a half, I decided it wasn't meant for me. So after work, I'd go to the public library and read till 10 o'clock every night. Everything I could on the mind. you know,
psychology,
the whole works.
Okay,
and so I'm self-taught.
Yeah,
but I've been very, very successful with hypnotherapy. I do it mainly with our sports people, with footballers, particularly with our top cricketers.
You mean like whenever they've been injured or something?
No, no. What happens is when they lose form.
Because they lose that competitive drive?
Well, no. Let's take a typical instance. I think I mentioned to you before about 1999 how I did a television show.
Yeah.
One of the phone calls that I got was from the wife of who in that time was the world's greatest number one batsman for one day cricket. Anyway, I don't follow sport. So she rang me from Sydney and she said, look, she said, very impressed with what you did. I rang my husband last night, who's in Pakistan on a test cricket tour. She said, and he asked me to ring to make an appointment. He's quite prepared to fly to Melbourne every week for sessions. I said, when's he due back? And she said, in 10 days' time. I said, get him to ring me. We'll discuss it on the phone. So he rang me. We spoke for about 3 hours. What had happened is he'd lost form. Now, when you lose form, when you're at the height, you know, of your sport, okay, irrespective of whether it's golf or whatever,
yeah,
for instance, I'd love to get hold of Tiger Woods. I reckon I could
yeah, straighten him out. Yeah, seems he'd lost his edge.
I mean, the point is this. The media crucifies you. The more you fail, the deeper the hole you dig.
Yeah.
And what I call the law of reversed effort comes in. And the law of reverse effort is the harder you try, the less you succeed. I give lectures on this. And in this instance, I make up a small CD. I have a 39-page booklet, and I explain in very simple terms the relationship between the conscious and subconscious mind and why, for instance, positive thinking fails 95% of the time, and I explain why.
That's it. And because it's usually it's the other way around. People are always trying, you know, think positive thoughts and everything.
Yeah, but it fails.
Huh.
The reason it fails is very simple. I'll try and do this in about 2 minutes. There's four fundamental laws you have to understand. There's the power of positive thinking, the power of negative thinking. The third one is, and I'll explain this quickly, when the willpower and the imagination are in conflict, the imagination will always win. And the fourth one is the law of reversed effort. Now, these four laws are intertwined. I'll try and explain them fairly quickly. Now, when the willpower and the imagination are in conflict, the imagination will always win. Let me give you a typical example which you would be conversant with. So let me give you a test. I say, Scott, I have a plank of wood. It's you're talking yards here, don't you?
Yes.
Okay. It's 24 inches wide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 4 inches thick.
All right.
And it's 40 feet long.
Okay.
Okay. And I put it between two chairs. And I ask you to stand up and walk the length of the plank without falling down. Now, it's 2 feet wide. You haven't been drinking. Do you think you can do that without falling?
Sure, because it's only 2 feet off the ground. Right.
Exactly. You take the same plank, you put it between two buildings with no safety net.
Right.
Now, here's the interesting point. 95% of right-minded people would not take it on for fear of falling.
Exactly.
The 5% that might try halfway across will end up falling to their death. The point here is this. When the willpower and the imagination are in conflict, the imagination will always win. So this is what brings us back to why the power of positive thinking fails. Positive thinking only works when you believe 100% without the slightest doubt that the positive affirmations you're giving yourself are going to work.
Yeah.
If there's the slightest doubt in your mind, it will work against you. The law of what I call the reversed effort will come in.
Okay.
It's a little bit difficult to explain in such short time because I do a whole seminar on this.
Huh.
But it's fascinating.
It is amazing. You know, I remember as a kid, a stupid kid, that, you know, walking up the side of a stairway.
Yeah.
And it was probably about three stories up. This was in St. Louis, and it was a outdoor stair step, and I was walking on, you know, it was probably about, as you say, about 2 feet wide, and I was walking up, actually kind of sprinting up, but, you know, for the first several steps. And, of course, as I got up higher, the steps were just to my left, so if I fell
and
to the left,
it
wasn't frightening until I looked to my right, and I could see that I'm now like two stories up, and suddenly I started slowing down,
freezing.
And finally, I froze, and I'm grabbing, you know, the thing, and I climbed off over onto the steps.
Exactly, because you started to doubt your ability.
That's correct.
Huh. This is it. Whereas now, for instance, why negative thinking is so destructive is this. When people think negatively, they believe 100% in that negative thought, and that flows straight through the subconscious, and the subconscious acts on it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the difference between the two. Mm. It's fascinating. If you look at my website, you'll see now, I have my two magic shows, or, you know, mentalism shows.
What's the website?
But I also do...
What's the website?
CharlesGalaxy.com.
Okay.
I have the Power of the Mind and the Mysteries of the Mind. Anyway, and I also do, and this is where I'm making most of my money now, my Hypno Dream program and the Memory program also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the beautiful part about this is, you see, as much as you probably might query my figures, but I've checked these out, as much as 69% of the public walking the streets today lack self-confidence and have low self-esteem.
Yeah.
That's an extremely high number.
It is.
And that's why I discovered this a few years ago, and I developed my Hypno Dream program. And now I have seminars, and then I have a little booklet, 39 pages, and it comes with a CD. And this is the difference between what I'm selling or what I'm true. There's hundreds of CDs on the web,
mm-hmm.
but they fail because they don't explain the simple principles of why we behave the way we are. My little booklet does.
You have to start with the fundamentals.
And the more you read it, the more you get out of it. And suddenly, the pennies will drop while you're doing certain things.
Yeah, interesting.
So it's fascinating, and I've had tremendous success stories.
I want to get to... After you had laid out for about 17 years and you got brought back into...
I was still doing... So. I was doing an average of only 25 shows a year, magic. I kept 6 corporate accounts.
When you were in your 20s or so? 30s?
Yeah, well, I got married at 23. I started professionally at 16.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I did it from 16 to 43.
Okay.
And then I gave, when I say I gave magic away, I hadn't given it away completely, but I only kept these 6 corporate accounts. I was more interested in doing hypnotherapy.
Hypnosis, okay.
And then I got back into it eventually.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to hear. I thought that was an interesting story you mentioned at lunch earlier.
Yeah.
Just to recount that again about how that you had gone to... an art opening or something?
Yes, I was in Nice on the French Riviera. We were holidaying, my wife and I were holidaying, and we were staying with a friend of mine whose name is Gerard Maynard. He was president of Club Magica in Nice. And we were staying at his house. And on the Thursday, he happened to say to me, and my wife was there, oh... we've been invited to a very important opening of an art exhibition. Would you and Catherine be interested in coming? Well, my wife is a designer, and of course, naturally, she's interested in art. She said, yes, of course we would. And about 45 minutes later, Jared came back, and he said, I just spoke to the director of the gallery.
Art gallery, yeah.
He said, and I happened to mention on the side that I had guests from Australia and what you do. And he turned around and said, "Oh, would you like to do something for us?" He said, "So I dobbed you in." So anyway, in view of the fact that he's a magician, he's a mentalist actually, like me, I was able to borrow a few things from him and put on a 20-minute show. And that's one of the main springboards of getting back. I mean, you know yourself, when you do a good show and the applause, it's not really the money. It's the applause that gives you the buzz.
Adulation. Mm-hmm.
And in this instance, here I am in France. That was my first time. And the response was fantastic.
Do you speak French?
I understand it. But I don't speak it as such. Now, this is the cream, the la creme of society.
Who speak international language themselves.
Yeah, I mean, these are very, you know. So it was a very select, it was by invitation.
Yeah.
We're not talking about ordinary men in the
street. It was another French Riviera.
And that was the springboard.
Because people saw you and said, "Hey, can you come do my show?"
Well, two people approached me afterwards. One was a commodore of the biggest yacht club. And if you see the boats that moor at this yacht club, that's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You're talking tens of millions of dollars.
Wow.
And he said, "I like what you did." He said, "Could you do that?" I only did 20 minutes. He said, "Could you do that at my club on Saturday?" Oh, he asked how long I was going to be there. I said, "Another 10 days. He said, "Could you do it on Saturday?" And I was flabbergasted. And I thought, I'll quote him a silly price and he might go away. And I did, and he accepted. And then later on, a woman approached me. Said, "I run an agency here. I can give you work for 6 months." Mm-hmm. And I thought, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
So I said, "Oh, look, just give me some time to discuss it with my wife." And then my wife pointed out rightly that our winter is their summer.
Right.
So I agreed to work only 3 months of the year. And I did that for 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that was
well and truly established.
Yeah, so that was during a great time. And you were working then on this guy's yacht? You said?
Oh, no, not on one. No, you're working on...
In clubs?
No, on the back of boats from Monte Carlo to Saint-Tropez.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got Cannes, you know, you've got Nice, you've got all these places.
Yeah.
I could tell you another very interesting story.
Okay.
I got booked to do a show. Paul Allen is Bill Gates' ex-partner.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He bought a house on probably one of the dearest stretches of land on earth in Cap Ferrat, which is about 20 minutes from Nice. This house he bought, I believe he paid 70 million euros for
wow.
it.
Wow.
And he spent 3 years doing it up. The house is right next to Villa Rothschild. Okay. So we're talking money.
Yeah, yeah. Serious money.
Anyway, I got booked to do a gig there. And afterwards, I was asked to mingle with the guests. And as it happens, the gardener in charge of 9 gardeners who for 3 years were really working on this place, apart from other, you know, carpenters and whatever.
Yeah.
He was downing double scotches as going out of fashion. And we sort of clicked, being Australians. And I said, "My God," I said, "you're certainly downing them." He said, "Oh, we installed a statue today," and I forget how much it was, tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And he said, "And we're frightened we might drop it."
So we're trying to steady our nerves with the...
Another time, and the same day, he was explaining to me, "I have no reason to believe this is not true." Because knowing how wealthy these people are, he's mentioned that Paul Allen apparently owned a, amongst other things, I think it was a baseball club.
Mm-hmm.
And he never stayed at the house when he flew over. He moored his yacht and he stayed on the yacht. Now, apparently, I've got to be careful here. I don't want to get sued. His sister was overseeing seeing the renovations.
Okay.
And she was very difficult to get on with. Anyway, so apparently one day his team was playing And apparently he couldn't get decent satellite reception.
Mm-hmm.
He made one phone call, and apparently $2 million later,
the satellite had readjusted.
And I thought to myself, well, yeah. No, that's how the other half lives.
Yeah, you call NASA and say, can you adjust that satellite? Yeah. Not my dish, yours. Wow.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, different way of living. Well, you know, along that line, I had talked with David Stone on the Magic Word a while back.
Yeah.
And he told me something fascinating about that. And he said that he had lost confidence as a result of working in on the Riviera. Because as he was going around, because similarly he had an agent said, okay, I can book you and you can make more money than your father makes. And he was doing fine. But he said he was having a great time. But occasionally, you know, somebody would say, hey, Magic Boy, come over here. They'd hand him $100 bill or 100 euro note or something and say, we don't want to see magic, stay away from us. We're just telling you to come over here now to keep away from us. And so there are a lot of people, he's not a lot, there were some people then who just don't want to be fooled. They don't like magic. I mean, they are at a certain level of income. And they do you experience
no,
that?
No, see, there's the difference. See, I'll tell you another thing. I used to table hop at a very... And it has a different connotation to what you use here.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very, we've got four of them, exclusive men's clubs in Melbourne.
Okay.
And I don't mean topless dancing.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the higher echelon of business community.
Yes.
And barristers, judges, et cetera, et cetera. That was another way I got a lot of work from. One of my magician friends, who's very, very wealthy, because he was a worked for a large accountancy firm, and he did the what do you call it when companies go broke? I'm just trying to think of the term.
Yeah.
Anyway, you earn something like $20,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's free. He belonged to this club, and so I said to Ken, "Would you do me a favor? Would you give me an introduction? I want to make him an offer they can't refuse." I'm against table hopping per se,
mm-hmm.
because to me it's an intrusion.
That's true.
If I take my wife out, the last thing I want is some idiot walking up to me wanting to do tricks.
I'm involved in the conversation privately with my wife.
So in this instance, I approached them, introduced myself, did my presentation kit, and I said, look, here's what I'm offering. I'm offering to work for nothing. I won't accept any tips. On a Friday and Saturday night, which are your busiest nights,
mm-hmm.
don't forget that I'd be performing to decision makers.
Right.
Right. And if I'm good enough and they like me enough, hopefully I'll get some work from it later on.
Mm-hmm.
And that really took off.
Wow.
And this is why we had a little tent card on the table.
Yeah.
And it introduced me. The compliments of the management. If you want to see me work, just book it through the waiter.
Okay.
So I didn't walk in on them cold. They requested me.
So it was by invitation for them
to
invite you to their table.
And of course, once I start working one table and they realize what I did, other people very quickly followed.
And are you doing walk-around mentalism?
Well... I'll tell you, in fact, I'm going to do one of the effects tonight. Because I wanted to really make a strong impact, I did one routine only, a memory routine, which I call Rain Man.
Okay, wow.
It takes about 7 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And I did it from table to table to table to table.
Mm-hmm.
And that really kicked me up. The amount of bookings eventually I got from that club were terrific. But I don't believe, I don't like table hopping per se. I've never done it. The only time I will do it, correction, is at weddings. But at weddings, people know each other.
Right.
And, so it's not a problem.
The wedding market in the U.S. is completely different than it is, I know, in the U.K., and I wonder how that differs from Australia. In other words, that I understand...
We have magicians and weddings,
you?
Yes.
Okay, so it's popular in Australia.
It is popular.
And are weddings all-day affairs in Australia like they are in the U.K.?
Yes.
They're not that way here in the U.S.
Aren't they?
No. I am ordained as a pastor, so I actually marry some people from time to time, but then sometimes I will also do magic afterwards. But in other words, after the ceremony, there are photos, and then there may be dinner or a buffet, or it might be just drinks or something, you know, at the reception. The reception will only last then maybe 2 hours. It could be, if it's an evening thing, perhaps it might last till midnight, and they'll have a band playing, so they'll be dancing and everything. So it'll play for a while. But usually, if people get married in the evening, then it kind of goes on. So it's not like an all-day deal. It includes lunch and dinner. I mean, you get...
Oh, no. Then, it's the same in Australia, but usually the reception lasts 3 or 4 hours.
Okay, well, see, in the UK...
Because you have a band, and that's when magician I perform in between, yes.
Yeah.
I can either do stand-up, or I can...
Stroll. Right. Yeah, as I understand from the UK, again, that some of the guys say, well, they have gone in the morning, and then they'll go back and change, come back later in the afternoon and do another show or something.
In Australia, definitely not an all day.
So,
because you got to understand, I mean, they're booking the place.
Yes, that's right. So they got
and these places might want to have 2 or 3 weddings in one day. So.
Right. Well... that's why I would think, say, that in the UK, they're booking castles or these big historical places. And
exactly.
Maybe they got them for the day, and they really want to take advantage
of it, be
there for a long time. Well, so magic is popular for weddings in Australia.
Yes.
It's hard to get bookings. There are not a lot of wedding magicians. People are willing to work magic at a wedding. But I think here that, women have a completely different idea, you know, that they're just thinking about wanting to have a band and have some fun, and a magician will take the attention away from me. You know, this is my day. I'm the princess. I have, my hair fixed up.
No, that's not the attitude. I mean, most of the bookings I get, again, they're not booked through agencies. It's referrals. Somebody see me at somebody's wedding.
Right. And they'll say, hey, it's a
lot
of fun.
And then they're going to get married or something. And
yep.
So, and
well, business
begets
business.
That's how it goes.
Sure.
Weddings generally are not booked through an agency.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of referrals, if you know what I mean.
Sure, yeah. Again, business begets business,
whatever
that you've been. Well, just like you were saying earlier, whenever that you had done that one show that was at that art gallery, and a couple of saw you, and one thing leads kind of to another. And so
I'm a great believer in that. I really believe, and I don't want you to think I'm up myself or anything, but I'm, 61 years is a long time to be doing it professionally.
Yeah.
So I must have done something right. And I mean, we're comfortable.
Right.
I've done very well at it. And the point is this, that I've always been very self-analytical, judgmental. Every show I do, every public show I do, I audio tape it. Every show. And I play it back. Not once, twice, three times.
Do you?
Because there's always something that I pick up. Somebody says something, causes a laugh, or somebody acts in a certain way. So, you're forever evolving the show. The show is never static.
Right. You can't forget those things sometimes that happen in the heat of the show, and you're having a lot of fun, and they laugh, and then you're concentrating on the balance of your
show.
But
that's what I mean. That's why I tape. Yeah. I can't video it, but at least I audio tape it before I go on. I just put...
Yeah, I remember Gene Anderson talking about that in Part-Time Professional, Part-Time Pro, a lecture. Gosh, I first heard that in 1981 or something, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about taping your shows. And, of course, now it's easy to video, even just with a phone or something, if you want to. And small video recorders that you can use. But I think just audio, I used to do that, but I don't do it as often as I did before. But that's probably a good idea to do them all.
Oh, I think, honestly, it is worthwhile doing. Because... sometimes you might spontaneously, although we all script a show.
Yeah.
Which brings me to another very important point, from my perspective anyway. I can only speak for me.
Yeah.
And we have to agree to disagree.
Okay.
Now, for instance, my body language effect. I use a lot of double entendres. Because the name of the game is to entertain. And usually entertainment involves comedy.
Correct.
Okay. Now, particularly here in the States, particularly if I'm performing at the Castle, I mean, this country is an enigma to me because on one hand, I can get onto 300 porn channels, and on the other hand, you've got a lot of religious fever here.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a simple thing that I do at the start of body language. The point I'm trying to get at is this. There's nothing wrong with scripting your act, mm-hmm. but the script should rise and fall depending on your audience.
Mm-hmm.
Most magicians, most inexperienced magicians, stick to a tight script, and that's wrong.
Okay.
Because one minute I'm performing for white collar workers,
yeah.
next minute I'm performing for blue collar workers.
Yeah.
I've got to come down to their level, frankly.
That's right. You can't have a cookie cutter for all audiences.
If I want to be successful,
right.
I want to be seen to be one of them.
You need a customer.
Do you understand?
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm a great believer in taping a show all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn.
Sure you do, yeah. Because sometimes you think that you are addressing them at their level, and you might find, ooh, I'm either above or below. I'm not where I should have been.
Like, yeah. I know out of 21 shows I did last time I was at the Castle, 18 I was very pleased with.
Yeah.
The other three I thought were ordinary because a performer relies on the feedback of the audience.
Well, that's a fact.
It's an interaction between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I try this gag. If the respond is very subdued, I say, well, I play it straight.
Yeah.
And just a straight show then.
Sure.
So, whereas if, you know, it raises a decent laugh, well, I'll continue feeling my way.
Right.
And I know how much I can get away with without offending the audience. Because that's the name of the game.
Yeah.
You've got to know where to stop.
Well, some people call that jazz magic. Which
I don't know what terms you use here. But
so that you kind of go with the flow of whichever way it's going to be going.
Yeah.
That you have the expertise in order to follow.
To judge, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It makes sure that you go along with the direction the crowd is. You know, I heard a joke a long time ago where the guy was saying, you know, how many surrealists does it take to change a light bulb?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is fish. You know, if the audience laughs, then you realize, okay, well, they're kind of a hip audience,
yeah.
and you know that they're
yeah.
more intellectual.
Exactly.
And if they look at you know, dumb looks, it's like, okay, we'll go in this direction.
Yeah. It's, you know, as I say, to me, the secret of success in magic is not to be in a tower, as it were, be conscious of your audience and be conscious of their response. And this is why the taping is so good, because you're able to play it back, you're able to see the response for every gag that you might try, you know. And if something fails, all right, it might fail once, it might fail twice. If it fails three times, you have to start doubting.
That's right.
Whether it should be left in the act.
That's the advantage of being able to do that act over and over. When I was working here at the Magic Island, I used to have Scott Hollingsworth, who was the entertainment director, and also the director, you know, during the shows. And so he would see me work three, four times a night, and, you know, he would, at some point, because he had seen the show, and he knows what's
so
solid
times,
and everything,
yes.
so many times, that he would say, okay, you might want to consider leaving out this particular joke, because it's just not working for you.
But do you understand what I mean?
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, that you have to recognize.
See, you yourself can't see the wood for the trees.
You can't. You need to, that's why it's important to have a director or some outside perspective.
Exactly.
Not all of us have that opportunity. You need to find someone who has a good eye and is not someone who's going to be too critical or
no. You
or
want
sycophant.
You don't want destructive criticism. You want constructive criticism.
Right.
And you should be a person that is prepared to accept.
Yeah.
Constructive.
That's right.
This is what's wrong with magic clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some guy who's an absolutely lousy performer.
Yeah.
Now, at my club, at one stage, to give you an idea, about 9 years ago, I said, why don't we have a night, and listen to me carefully, where you come and perform your act, and we'll video it.
Yeah.
And then three or four of the senior members of the club, privately, will give you some constructive, what their thought is on it.
And?
Not one person took it up.
Hmm.
Which shows you how poor that is.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, it's a wonderful opportunity to think, you know, you're performing an audition, as it were,
mm-hmm.
and
And you're getting private feedback also. It's not like
it's private. Yes, we're not crucifying them. We're not crucifying. Yeah. But, you know, we think maybe you should consider doing this or doing that or doing that. You know, that's strong. That's not strong. And I don't know if it's ever been tried. You should try it at your club one night and see what the response would be.
Yeah, to see who would take him up.
Because at the end of the day, this is a wonderful thing about videos today. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you... Now, mind you, this can work for you and it can work against you. It can be very, in a way, maybe in thinking about it. Because once you see yourself, it's like hearing your own voice.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
sounds Don't so like, strange.
Exactly.
So if you see yourself in action and you're honest with yourself, you might not like what you see. You might end up losing confidence. So in a way, it can be dangerous.
Yes, right, right. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I appreciate the time, and as we start to wrap up over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word.
Oh, yes.
And so my question would be what your magic word might be. What is it that's important in your life? It could be a phrase. It could be a slogan, you know, something that you live by, a philosophy of life. You know, what...
My magic word is a sentence that I use just before I fall asleep each night.
Okay.
And again, it's to do with hypnosis. And that is, the older I get, the younger I feel. And I'd like to think at 77, I don't look my age. So I practice what I preach.
Yeah. The older I get, the younger, younger I feel.
That's how I stay young.
That's great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Charles Gauchy, for being my guest
today.
Thank you,
Scott, for having me.
You're welcome. For the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out.
Thanks again to Charles Gauchy for spending some time and sharing some of his intimate details of his background and secrets to his success. I hope you enjoyed this podcast, too. If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or make a suggestion, then join the discussion over on Facebook at facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast. And if you or someone you know is looking for a way to advertise your business to thousands of magicians around the world that will live almost forever on the Internet, then please contact me for ad rates. You can drop me an email at scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. I appreciate your support and look forward to seeing you back here next week with an all-new, very special 200th Christmas podcast. Until then, this is Scotty out.